Hey, Will, like I normally do, I just want to take a moment to tell our listeners to make sure they hit us up on social, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, wherever you might see us. Make sure you're sending us something. Also, you can email us directly at appalachiameetsworld@gmail.com. If you get a moment, shoot us a line, give us some feedback.
Yeah, and wherever you listen to the podcast, make sure you subscribe to Appalachia Meets World. It just helps our podcast, but it also helps you know when we're releasing a new episode.
You know, this region has a rich culinary tradition, just as rich as anywhere in the world. And part of that richness is, you know, we got all kinds of subregions.
Appalachia Meets World, a podcast about place and perspective, but always Appalachian.
And don't forget, Will, tonight's episode is powered by SOAR.
Shaping our Appalachian region. If you're an entrepreneur out there, especially in Eastern Kentucky, check them out. Appalachia Meets World. We're back another week. It's Will.
And Neil, what is happening, my brother?
What's going on? We missed you last week.
Been a struggle for old Neely lately. You know, just life, busyness. We need to prioritize better, you know?
Yeah, you do. That's understandable, though.
I try, but sometimes I fail. You know, I don't know if anybody else can relate.
Yeah, maybe Angel Reese.
Ooh, glad you brought that up. Yeah, she can. She can definitely relate to failure. She doesn't handle failure well, Bill.
Yeah, she doesn't. Which you know, as a competitor, I can understand that. It's hard. It's hard to handle defeat sometimes.
Of course I watched, Will. Me and 12 million other people. I might not see all your awards ceremonies and things in Hollywood, but I definitely catch high-rated sporting events.
Yeah. The women's NCAA tournament. It's a big draw this year, right?
Well, I can tell you this. I've never, ever watched the NCAA Women's Elite Eight until recently.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah, I look for Caitlin Clark to have a huge impact on the WNBA. What do you think?
I think she already is.
Maybe the next highest paid female basketball player ever. I don't know.
Yeah, I think she'll get more money, but I think it'll also increase the pay for other women in the sport as well, which is a good thing.
Yeah, for sure. Fun to watch. I know that.
Yeah, and speaking of the NCAA tournament, you know, the cats got beat, so we won't even talk about the men's side. But I did want to bring up the appetizer.
Yeah, there's another tournament going on, Will. People,
that's
people
right.
May not know about.
We've mentioned it a time or two. We haven't really posted it, but we have gotten some votes. So we're down to the final four, Neil.
Yeah, just for those listeners that maybe haven't caught us in a couple of weeks, every episode we always ask our guests what their favorite appetizer is. And we decided in the season of tournaments, we would have a greatest appetizer NCAA / app tournament. Things are going well. I'm sure that my favorite will eventually win. But what do you got us down to, Will?
I know we haven't posted the full 64, but we narrowed it down to 32 and then 16 and now eight and now the final four. But I wanted to, we have a throwback episode this week, but we also want to talk about these appetizers, which gets us into food. But I wanted to highlight the, at least the Sweet 16, maybe go through it with you, get us down to the final four and show you how the votes kind of went from there.
Sounds good. Let's do it.
So, and we'll call it the East bracket. We had Vienna sausages and crackers. Yeah. It came through all the way to the Sweet 16. It was up against Buffalo Dip. And then in the bottom of that bracket, it was Hanky Panky appetizer up against cream cheese with the jelly. You know, the hot pepper jelly on top.
Oh, yeah.
So I felt like the East had a pretty strong bracket there.
Strong bracket. I know where the winner's going, though.
Oh, yeah. I'll go ahead and go through this bracket. So Vienna sausage and buffalo dip, it wasn't close. In my opinion, I feel like that's close. There's a little nostalgia connected to Vianney sausages. But Buffalo Dip went through. Hanky Panky got beat by the cream cheese and hot pepper jelly, which is a good one in my book as well. But on to the final four was Buffalo Dip, I think, to no surprise.
Of course, as soon as that nostalgia comes up in your brain, and then boom, Buffalo Dip hits, you know it's over.
It's over. Over.
I don't even know what the point spread was on that, but it's not close.
No, it wasn't. The vote wasn't really close. Oh, now on to the Southeast. So we had actually making it to the Sweet 16 was a charcuterie board, and that's with meats and cheeses. You know, a lot of our guests have actually mentioned that, not just charcuterie, but like meats and cheese boards have been pretty popular. But they went up against the firecracker. You know what I'm talking about. The saltines that are baked in the hot pepper and whatever. I don't even know how to make them, but you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. I do. I'm with you.
All right. And then in the bottom of that bracket, sausage balls against the ever-traditional pimento cheese.
Oh, that's a tough matchup.
That is, right?
That's a tough Sweet 16 game.
Strong bracket there. So in regards to the charcuterie board and firecrackers, surprisingly, the votes from our fans went to the firecrackers.
Oh, that's an upset.
Yeah, upset. And then in the bottom of the bracket, sausage balls against pimento cheese. Sausage balls went through.
Yes, sir. It's all about how you make them, though. So it must have been a good recipe here. So I give them the odds on favorite in this bracket. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But who goes to the final four?
Like you just said, the sausage balls beat out the firecrackers. Yeah. Sausage balls to the final four.
Just like the women's Elite Eight bracket, the favorite usually wins.
Over to the West, we have spinach artichoke dip and pepperoni rolls, the traditional West Virginia treat.
Going all the way out to the West Coast to compete this game, Will.
I don't know about it. A lot of travel there.
Tough matchup, too.
Those dips, man. Those dips have been in every category. People love the dips. On the bottom of that bracket, we got the traditional, which it doesn't, I don't guess it necessarily has to be salsa, but chips and salsa or chips and ranch, you know, chips and dip.
It does come down to the dip or the chip.
That's true. In my opinion. So we'll go with whole grain Tostitos and salsa, but they're going up against the number one seed, deviled eggs.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner. Gotta go. Come on, I'm putting all my money on the deviled egg.
No surprise there. In the top of the bracket, pepperoni rolls actually went through over spinach artichoke. Yeah, a long trip out west. Must have been a lot of West Virginia voters in that category.
Glad to travel as well.
Bottom of the bracket, on cruise control, deviled eggs, no problem, went through.
Oh yeah, you know this is they're walking to the final four, man. It's like this year's UConn men's team.
Yeah, they definitely won by 30 over at least over the pepperoni rolls, deviled eggs all the way. They're in the final four.
Yes, awesome. I love it.
Yeah, down in the Southwest, we got calamari, which I don't recall has been said by a lot of guests. It has been said by a couple, but it never was strong, but it went to the Sweet 16, but it was up against the Rotel.
Oh yeah,
the Rotel sausage dip. Yeah.
Yes, that's a tough matchup.
That is. Both some good stuff there. Bottom of the bracket, we have Little Smokies made it. Little Smokies wrapped in bacon.
Gosh, my mouth is watering at this point.
Man, you know what who they're going up against? The number one seed, shrimp.
Cocktail shrimp. Yeah, okay. So that's going to be a tough contest for anybody to get the shrimp cocktail. Of course, it's going to come down to what you're dipping it in. Cocktail sauce has got to be on point for the shrimp to overtake anybody, in my opinion.
You know, like you just said, shrimp went through, but also the Rotel. The Rotel tomato and sausage is a hidden gem. I mean, that stuff, if it's made
it really
well,
is. It's like quality. It's like the 11 seed NC State Wolfpack. I mean, you never know, but it could just creep up on you and overtake everybody.
I agree. However, through the votes, shrimp went through.
I'm not surprised. I mean, eventually everybody's Cinderella story ends, you know.
So Rotel went down, the Cinderella took off the slipper. Even though it's really, really good, it went down. So we now have in the final four, shrimp going against deviled eggs on one side, buffalo dip going against sausage balls on the other side. That's the final four this year.
Ooh, golly. I don't know what's more exciting for me. I mean, honestly, this year with the way things have gone in the actual tournament, I think this is more exciting for me. I mean, I'm a foodie in general. I love appetizers. Not necessarily meals, but appetizers is like maybe my favorite thing of all time. It's been incredible. Like I said a few minutes ago, my mouth is literally watering just thinking about some of these appetizers.
Could you get a better Final Four than buffalo dip, deviled eggs, sausage balls, and shrimp cocktail?
Well, how many days has it been since you've had one of those four?
Well, I just went on vacation, so I had shrimp like every day.
Okay, so it's been what, 3-4 days?
Yeah.
A week? Buffalo dip, how long has it been?
It's been a while. I'm not going to lie. Usually when I eat buffalo dip, I make it. So it's been a while since I've made it, at least 6 months.
Oh, my gosh. What is wrong with you?
Right, yeah.
I mean, you didn't have any on the Super Bowl? That's been less than 6 months ago.
I was out of town on the Super Bowl, so.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. All right. What about deviled eggs?
To be honest, it's been a while for deviled eggs, too. Now, I've had hard-boiled eggs, but.
So disappointing.
I know, right?
I mean, we just celebrated Easter. I know you didn't come home, as usual. I had 8 on Easter Sunday.
I was getting ready to say, had I come home, I would have had deviled eggs.
You wouldn't have had many because I was there. But
this is true.
I mean, I'm so disappointed in your recent food habits. But
I know, same with sausage balls. I can't remember the last time I had a sausage ball.
I was about to say, I mean, sausage balls is probably one that I don't eat that often. Love them. It's a time-consuming deal to make sausage balls, to be honest. If you're going to do it right anyway. Yeah, I don't like the ones that are like pre-made, frozen. You just bake them. I don't like those. Those are no good. Yeah. You got to get your hands dirty with a sausage ball.
But you use the Bisquick. You like the Bisquick sausage balls, right? Recipe?
I do, yeah. Yeah. With extra cheese. Yeah.
We'll say that's what these are. Solid Final Four.
Very strong. Very strong. I know where the bettors are going. I know where the odds are going in this particular case. But you're not going to win much money if you're betting on deviled eggs because they got to be the odds-on favorite. I don't know. You never know. You never know who comes out of this Final Four. But golly, it's been interesting. I can tell you that.
Definitely. We'll see where the votes take us. It's definitely been interesting. Coming out of the appetizer, you know, tournament bracket that we've had kind of makes me just think about food in general and how it's such a cultural component to not only Appalachia, but all other regions. It makes you think about place. Like we said before, it brings up that nostalgia, and food is just important, I think, for most Appalachians. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely Appalachians, but food in general is just a unifier, Will. I think is a great way to describe food. And for us, if you've ever listened to one of our episodes, we've probably talked about food at some point. If you look at both of us, we don't look like we necessarily love food as much as we do, thank goodness. But we both have a love of food. And it trickles down throughout our family and, you know, to other families as well. So food is definitely a unifier for the entire country. And I'm always happy to talk about it. I know this episode's going to be interesting to our listeners just to hear more about food.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. We're going to have a throwback episode. We're going to be throwing back to one of our original episodes, episode 15, when we had Melissa Booth Hall on. She is originally from kind of the area where we grew up, but she now is with the Southern Foodways Alliance, and she talks all about food, the cultural aspect in Appalachia, and a little bit of history in regards to how she grew up. It's an interesting throwback that we just wanted to have on this episode, but me and you are just going to talk a little bit about food in general. They just yesterday came out with the James Beard Award finalists. I know you don't necessarily follow that, Neil, but when you go to a restaurant, you will always hear if the chef is a James Beard Award winner or was nominated to a certain extent. I wanted to mention that because of all the finalists, they have a number of categories, a number of finalists, I don't know, probably 100, maybe not that many, 75 finalists overall in regards to all the categories. But from what I could tell, I went through the list, only one is from Appalachia. Now, this is not like in the past. Wow. We've had a lot of, there are a lot of Appalachian winners of the James Beard Award. There are a lot of Appalachian finalists, but this year only one. Does that shock you?
It's very shocking to me because I don't know. I feel like Appalachia is the heart of good food. You know, every restaurant I go to, I always check the menu to see if there's a James Beard Award winner listed on the menu, or I usually don't eat there. That was total sarcasm. I hope you guys picked up on it. Yeah. But it is shocking that only one. Where is that one from?
You know, it is a prestigious award, especially from the culinary community. And that award finalist this year is at the restaurant 1010 Bridge in Charleston, West Virginia. It's Paul Smith. He cooks some traditional Appalachian cuisine and puts his spin on it. And it's supposed to be an incredible restaurant there in Charleston, West Virginia.
Well, I'm glad to learn more about the most Appalachian name I've ever heard in my life, Paul Smith. And I hope he wins the award, and I hope we can have him on the show because that just screams Appalachia to me.
Yeah, I would love to eat at his restaurant too. I'm not gonna lie. Maybe we will try to get him on the show and see if he wants to talk a little food with us. Not that we know much, but maybe he can break down the appetizer Sweet 16 a little more thoroughly than we did.
Hopefully he's at least had them all being an Appalachian, but you never know, I guess, until we talk to him. But interesting stuff, Will. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Since we're talking all about food and how much food is a cultural aspect, not only to the Appalachian culture, but to all cultures, really, I wanted to ask you a few questions. You know, you mentioned how important food was to us and to our family and how it brings us, kind of unifies us. We probably did this every night. We had a family meal, but I feel like people are so busy these days that that's far and few between amongst family. But we always, in my family, my wife and kids, we try to have at least one family meal a week, usually on Sundays, but we, you know, if we can have more, we do, but we're so busy, we try to at least have one. How about you guys?
Yeah, we do the same. Every opportunity that we have to sit down and eat together, we try to make it a point. I would say that it happens more than once a week. It's not every night of the week like it was when you and I were growing up. Time, man. Time just gets away, and the ease of getting food on the go has become something that many, many Americans and Appalachians are grown accustomed to. But we definitely make it a point to sit down 2-3 nights a week and eat together, share that time together. For us, sometimes there's we're often yelling at a kid to put down their phone at this point.
But yeah, I thought your point about the ease of fast food has become much more prominent these days, which I think is true when you're talking about having a sit down family meal like we did almost every single night when we were younger, which obviously, as you well know, we were very involved in extracurricular activities. But I felt like back then those extracurricular activities, whoever was running them, made a point to be done by dinner time, quote unquote dinner time. Now with extracurricular activities and my kids, it's all night long up until 9, sometimes 9:30 at night. So there's no rest for a family meal.
Yeah, well, I have a theory on that. I think, you know, when you and I were growing up, we were involved in everything sports related. I guess we don't often remember some of those early years of our sporting lives, whereas now it's gotten even earlier. So the constant tug to specialize for kids and the fact that they feel like they need to practice every single day. I mean, we didn't have that. It really hit us hard when we got to like school teams, and then usually school teams were able to manage a practice after school, and then dinner time was usually held off on because that's what families did. But there's so many non-traditional families now that's kind of changed all over the country and also in Appalachia, which is sad in a way to me, but also just the tale of the times, I guess.
Since we're talking about, you know, this episode is all about food, and we could go in so many different directions. And speaking of, we should probably try to have more food episodes on than we've had in the past. You know, we talk about it a lot, and we even talk about it with every single guest. But maybe we should focus on that a little bit more in the future in regards to episodes. But I wanted to ask you a few favorite food questions to get your wheels spinning a little bit before we throw it back to the old episode. What's your favorite Appalachian food? I know we've talked about this in the past a little bit, but do you have a favorite that you would consider truly Appalachian food?
A good roast in the crock pot? Does that count?
That counts. I mean, in my book, it counts.
I mean, I think that's probably as Appalachian as you can get, with a good roast beef stewing all day long with some potatoes and carrots. And
I was just getting ready to ask you what would you put in it, and I was just getting ready to say potatoes and carrots.
Yeah, for sure. You know what the kicker with that is, though, Will? It's kind of like our secret recipe: jalapenos.
Ooh, you mean like on top, or just like with the carrots?
Just
and
like
potatoes.
Just like two jalapenos in there all day long with the carrots and potatoes gives it just an extra little spark, if you will. And you should try it. It's phenomenal.
Wow. Yeah, I will definitely try that. I think you probably know my answer to this question, but
that's the only reason I didn't say it.
I think if anyone has ever listened to all of our episodes, but a lot of our episodes in the past, I've mentioned this a time or two, my favorite meal in general, if I could have my last meal, it would be soup, beans, and cornbread. Crumble up the cornbread into the soup, beans, little onions in there. That's really all I need. I mean, that is my favorite meal. Of course, Mom would always make salmon patties, some mac and cheese on the side with the soup, beans, and cornbread. But soup, beans, and cornbread, number one in my book, definitely a last meal.
Yeah, I didn't want to steal your thunder. I knew you were going to answer. So, yeah, I knew you'd say that. But, everybody loves that. Well, everybody that we know loves that as well.
And the people that don't just call it pinto beans, which is totally wrong.
Yeah, sacrilegious.
Yeah, the question I had for you. You know, we talked about the importance growing up that our family put on family meals. I think Mom, literally, and I tell people this to this day, she cooked us three meals a day. And people are just flabbergasted to find out that growing up, our mom fixed us breakfast before we went to school. You know, if we were home and we're not at school, she would fix us lunch. But she always had a hot meal at dinner on the table every single day, every single night. So I wanted to ask you, do you have a favorite dish that Mom cooks? I'm going to be honest. There are a lot of things that Mom's cooks, that our mom cooks, that I don't like. But do you have a favorite dish that Mom cooks?
Man, as I get older, everything she makes is good. But, you know, I can vividly remember not liking some things, but we always ate something. I don't know. She does a great lasagna. Gosh, what does she make that's not good, Will?
Well, I guess it's a preference thing for me.
You know what she makes that's really spot on every time I eat it because of the extra stuff. I mean, I could go to Mom's right now and tell her I was hungry, and she would randomly find the most random things in the world and make the best salad of all time.
Just the salad? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just the way she makes the salad. Like, you know, sometimes I don't have all that ingredients at my house, but Mom will have carrots, and she'll have tomatoes, and she'll have cucumbers, and she'll just cut all that stuff up rapid fire and have it all –
just right. And then she'll have a random yellow pepper in her refrigerator. And I mean, it just, she can put together a great salad.
Do you think it's because, and I thought about this way more than I should. I've thought about this a lot. Do you think it's just because it's someone else or it's mom fixing it? Because I've tried over and over to fix a really good sandwich, just a sandwich for myself, but it's never been as good as the sandwich that mom will make for you. Do you know what I mean?
I think a lot of it is just the fact that it's at mom's. It just makes it better.
Yeah, I think you're right. She makes a pretty good meatloaf for some reason. I probably agree with you. A lot of what she makes is really good. Chicken and dumplings. She makes some mean chicken and dumplings.
It's a classic. I mean, even mom's leftovers are better than my meals.
And as we well know, you could very well go in her refrigerator and find leftovers from like 8 months ago.
We could go today and eat for a month just on leftovers. And they would be good. Like, I hate leftovers at my house. But do you think her microwave works better than ours? I mean, how does leftovers
her oven works better. I think her frying pans work better. And definitely her microwave works better than mine.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
I also wanted to ask you, do you have any favorite food memories from grandmother and papaw that you can think of?
Not necessarily a particular meal or food, or we ate KFC a lot after church on Sunday. I can vividly remember that, but I think about Papa, I think about those 9 p.m. Reese cups.
I know.
I mean, the man loved Reese cups, loved them.
On top of that, if you were leaving his house, he would push you at the door with a banana. He made sure that you had a banana on your way out. And so you're walking out and you're thinking, oh, this guy's kind of a healthy dude. He's fresh fruit on your way out the door. But then come 9 p.m., it's Reese cup, it's cornbread and buttermilk. It's anything in the candy drawer that he could find.
Yeah, and they always had that drawer at the end down there that was just like full of fresh Reese cups all the time.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever pulled that drawer open and it not have Reese cups in it.
Another thing that I think about when I think of Papa and grandmother was the worst baker of all time. She was one of the better cooks I've ever known, but she could not bake to save her life. But one thing that this has nothing to do with baking. I just wanted to mention that. But one thing that I think they had at every single meal, just kind of as a side, our mom always had cornbread usually, but country ham was a staple at grandma and papa's.
Yeah, it's true. I think that's the only time I ever ate it. Honestly.
Yeah, I would never order it at a restaurant, or I don't think I ever eat it otherwise, but they always had it.
That's true.
Another question. Just from where we grew up, do you have a favorite restaurant? Obviously, it doesn't have to be Appalachian, but it's in Appalachia. But I'm thinking of one in particular that's no longer there. But do you have a favorite restaurant?
Floco? Is that what you're thinking of?
Oh, now that was good, but no, that's not what I was
thinking. Ingles? I mean, is that what you were thinking of? Because it's still there.
Still there.
Yeah. Ate there not too long ago, actually. Oh, you're thinking about the place Papaw would take us out across from the golf course, the little shack. What was?
I'm not thinking that, but now that you mentioned it, that place was solid. I don't even think it had a name.
It was our lunch spot.
Yeah, and also Mel's. You remember Mel's Diner?
I don't even think I remember Mel's. Must have been before me.
Yeah, you might have been too young. It was there for a while, but there's always the Lodge. I mean, as far as
thinking about Druthers.
Favorite restaurants of all time may be like sit down restaurants, the Lodge at the
State Park.
State Park, yeah. You just said it. I think I overspoke you.
Druthers.
Yes. Yes. Do you remember Druthers?
I do. I was pretty young, but I do remember going to Druthers like every Sunday. And I remember the place being packed every time we were there.
Always. Fish and chips.
I don't ever remember eating a meal and the restaurant not being packed, like people everywhere.
Yeah, and it was just like a fast food joint.
Yeah, I don't know if it just seemed that way because I was so little and so young, or if it was really packed.
But that being said, we only had like three restaurants growing up like that.
That's true. And we knew everybody in the restaurant.
Now that I think about it, it had such a weird and unique menu. I mean, it was burgers and fries, but it also had like I said, fish and chips. So it had this fish and chips meal. It had like biscuits. It just had a weird and unique menu that it was all was just seemed so good at the time.
I mean, there's no way that kitchen would pass inspection nowadays. It's part of what made it great. And our culture now would not accept it.
At least it seemed fresh when we were eating it then. It was probably not, but it seemed that way. And I remember I still have a picture of the queen bee and my name on the sign for my, I think it was my 8th birthday, maybe. Happy birthday, Will, from the queen bee. That was their mascot.
Well, it may not pass inspection, but I would eat there again right now if I could go back in time.
Definitely. That's really all the questions that I had. I just want to talk to you a minute about food, about our family. We don't get to sit and talk too often. We always have guests on, even though we're having a short little throwback this week. It's always good to sit down and chat a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's anytime you talk about food, it sparks my interest. So you said earlier we're going to do more food episodes. I'm looking forward to it. I'm always more engaged when we're talking about food. I don't know. Something's wrong with me.
Now that we kind of got through food, we're going to, like I said, hand it over to the Melissa Booth Hall episode. But I wanted to throw out a little bit of app news real quick. SOAR, that we mentioned in the beginning of our episode, is having the Appalachia Pitch Contest April 14th. So if you're in the area, we'll post it in the show notes, but definitely check it out. They have some finalists that are going to be pitching, going to be winning some prizes, I think up to $10,000. So I just wanted to mention that briefly since we didn't really have any app news on this week.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, Will. I almost forgot to ask you about app news, so glad you didn't let us forget. But it's been a great episode, man. Good time. And I know our listeners will enjoy hearing more about the Southern Food Alliance as we depart the episode and let you hear more from our previous guest.
Let's kick it over to her, and we're not going to have a closing, so I guess we can end it like we usually do. Till next time.
Peace.
We have on the episode tonight Melissa Booth Hall, who is the managing director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, or what we'll probably refer to as SFA as we go through this episode. She is a graduate of Center College and Chase Law School and currently resides in Oxford, Mississippi, and has for the past 20 years. However, she is a proud Appalachian expat, I guess you could call, from Millersburg or Bell County, Kentucky. So, Melissa, we wanted to welcome you to the show and say thank you for being a part of this episode.
Thanks for asking me.
Well, one thing we wanted to kick it off with is something that we ask all our guests, and that is...
I predict this will be the best answer yet, by the way.
And it's perfect for this episode.
Perfect.
This is kind of the kickoff to our food Appalachian food series. We'll have several episodes on food and food ways, but you are the inaugural episode. But that question is, as Appalachia is big on history, big on tradition, Neil and I's family, we're big on tradition too. One of the traditions we have appetizers at the holidays. I mean, we have a huge spread of appetizers, usually more appetizers than the actual meal, but we wanted to ask you to kick it off. Do you have a favorite appetizer or just holiday dish, I guess?
So, yes. But I'm actually going to, in keeping with the theme, I'm going to do a throwback.
Nice.
So, my mother's mother, my Mama Lehman, was, she was the only one of her siblings to graduate from high school. And she was always very proud of that. And she, we think, maybe junior or senior year in high school, she had a hard-hitting, fantastic home ec teacher whose focus was like on apparently like being a lady. And one of the things that we think she picked up from this home ec class was she loved a relish tray. Back in the day, you could actually like buy this plate. So it was like a round glass plate that kind of has some like dividers in it. And that's because you're going to put your like your little pickles in one spot and this, that, and the other. But her, like, you knew it was Thanksgiving or Christmas because you got celery with that cheese from a jar.
Yeah.
You know, those little bitty jars. And in fact, you can't find that cheese here. They still sometimes have it like at the Food City when I'm at home. But yes, so that celery with that cheese from a jar was like, hey, it's Christmas. The other thing she did every year for the holidays, which none of us have, like we can all follow a recipe, we could do this, but she made boiled custard for Christmas every year. And that's the, I don't know if y'all have had it, but that's the, it's kind of like melted soft serve, only like it was never soft serve. It's this long, long process of standing over like a barely warm stove, stirring things. It's thick, creamy. It's probably, you know, like she would serve it in these little tiny like punch cups.
It's not a shot.
It's like, but it, you know, I would conservatively estimate that like a half cup of that probably has like 800 calories. I mean,
that is fantastic.
It's so good. But none of us ever make it.
So why don't you make it? Just because it's so labor intensive?
Yeah, nobody makes it because nobody, like, I mean, that was like it's a day long project.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And one where like you can't really step away from the stove unless you want to end up with like a pot of highly sweetened scrambled eggs. I mean, those are the two things. My other grandmother, my Granny Booth, my dad's mother, her big Thanksgiving thing was oyster dressing, which I always found fascinating because, as y'all know, we're landlocked. Like, I mean, like, I never really understood when she started making it or how she got that idea. And she would do it with like the canned oysters, obviously, but oyster dressing and boiled custard, those are my holiday nostalgia.
No, that's a fantastic answer. And I would expect nothing less from the first food expert that we've had on the show.
But I'm not going to lie. I still, like, whenever I see celery, I always think, like, this would be so much better with a little bit of that cheese in a jar in it. Yeah. So
now that we kind of have that question out of the way, I guess we can ask you, you know, for the listeners that don't know, what exactly is the Southern Foodways Alliance and kind of what do you do there?
Okay. So we are a cultural nonprofit based at the University of Mississippi. We are an institute of the Center for the Study of Southern Culture. There are the center at the University of Mississippi was the first of its kind, a place where you come to understand the South through one of its lenses. So you might use music as a way to understand the South. You might use the literature of the region. You certainly could use history. You might use art. And the Southern Foodways Alliance, our founder, John T. Edge, was actually a student at the Center for the Study of Southern Culture in the 90s. And his question was, why not food? As we offer these lenses for how to understand this region, food ought to be one of the tools we use. So the SFA began at the center. That is our home. And what we do is we document, study, and explore the diverse foodways of the changing American South. You know, if you broke down that lovely mission statement, what you would want to know about us is our documentary work is We make films about people across the South who grow, make, and serve great Southern food. And the other part of our documentary work is our oral history work. We now have, I think, probably coming up on just over 1,000 oral histories of that same group of people. And it is everything from catfish folks on the Mississippi Delta to people in Eastern Kentucky who are still making and serving chili dogs, to bartenders in New Orleans, to fishermen in Charleston, South Carolina. In fact, the project that our oral historian is working on right now is a project called Southern Sugars, where she's talking to sorghum growers across the region. So it's really anything you can think of that has to do with Southern food. Chances are the SFA has tried to capture somebody's story, somebody's experience with that food. And the ones we haven't gotten to, we're, you know, they are firmly in our sights. They are our next goal.
Yeah, you all have an excellent website for those that haven't gone to it. Go to it, check it out. It's definitely great. It's easy.
And it's all free. And it's all, you know, we started this way. We started with an eye toward all of the stories we collect, all of the voices we amplify are of this region, belong to this region, and should be shared as widely as possible.
Yes.
So that documentary part's a big part of what we do. We also have a quarterly journal, Gravy. We have a podcast called Gravy, where we use narrative nonfiction to tell stories about the South. And then, you know, we have two graduate students every year. We have a professor at the center now who's a foodways professor. So that's what we do.
You mentioned John T. Edge. Anybody that watches the SEC Network has seen his documentaries on there. They're excellent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So there, I think another season is about to ramp up. So
great. And you spoke of, you know, the Southern foodways and food of the region. And that's where I kind of wanted to ask you a question about, you know, this podcast is about Appalachia, but it's also comparing Appalachia to other regions, other cultures. And the more that we do that, the more similarities that we see with Appalachia and places outside of Appalachia. But that being said, you know, you can be Appalachian and also be Southern, but you don't, all Southerners aren't necessarily Appalachian. So I wanted to ask you, how do you separate Appalachia food from Southern food? Especially, I know that one of your symposiums in the past has been dedicated to strictly Appalachian cuisine. So how do you separate the two?
So here's the thing, and I think, and don't Google or Wikipedia me on this, but essentially, you know, the notion I would offer you is this. The American South is bigger than by a little bit, but, you know, comparable in land size to Western Europe. You would never, ever, ever say that you had had European food. You would say you had French food. You would say you had Italian food. You would say you ate in a pub in England. You know, you would say you had haggis in Scotland. But you would never like try to wrap your arms around and say, this is European cuisine. And what I would say about the American South is I think that we would probably help ourselves if we could figure out a way to start talking about our cuisine in that way. Because the reality is, you know, there absolutely are Appalachian foodways and purveyors of that and people who understand that cuisine in the same way that there are people who understand low country food, in the same way that there are people who understand the difference, you know, the difference between Western North Carolina and Eastern North Carolina barbecue. You know, this region has a rich culinary tradition, just as rich as anywhere in the world. And part of that richness is you know, we got all kinds of subregions and parts of this place know a thing where other parts of this place don't. And that's, to me, like fantastic evidence of what a rich and vibrant cuisine we have in the South. Yeah. Oh, so about Appalachia. So, you know, I mean, here's the thing. I grew up understanding about things like shuck beans and stack cakes, and I'll stick with those two. You know, and there are people, I sit here in the state of Mississippi, there are people here who grew up understanding caramel cake and field peas in a way that I really didn't until I got here. So I think that, you know, for all of the parts of the South, I think we're always in conversation with each other because we're always moving around, we're moving out, we're coming back. But I also think that I like to travel, and I think it's fun to go somewhere where you can have a thing that you can't have anywhere else in the world, or a thing that because you're there, because you're in that place, it's the best version of itself. And, you know, and again, I think that's what will keep us an interesting region. If we're all like Wendy's at the exit of on I-75, I don't hold out much hope for us in that scenario.
And to that point, you know, like you're saying, Appalachia so diverse, you know, it was built by these indigenous groups of Cherokees, by Scotch-Irish, by German immigrants, by enslaved and free Black Americans. Like you mentioned, we have Italians in West Virginia, the yep. Hungarians in Virginia, Albanians in East Tennessee. We have all, you know, this rich, diverse populations and ethnicities throughout. With this diversity, how do we and how should we celebrate it? I know SFA kind of prides itself on that, but you know, how should we as a region celebrate the diversity?
We kind of get asked that question a lot. I think that there's this idea about Southern food that there is, you know, some, I don't know, platonic ideal of, you know, the Southern table. And anytime you step away from that, I don't know, maybe you're putting a foot wrong. But I think the reality is, I think that platonic ideal holds us back more so than it pushes us forward. And I think that if we as Southerners say Southern food is these ingredients and it's these dishes, I think that, you know, very quickly we're going to be dealing with a cuisine that belongs in a museum rather than a living, vibrant, changing cuisine. And, you know, what I would say is to you, you know, you gave a fantastic recitation of just some of the influences on Southern food that have come literally from all over the world. And the reality is that's always been our story. You know, this is, we're not talking about like, you know, the 2010 census. You know, we're talking about the 1910 census, right?
Right, right.
So I think that we need to, as Southerners, understand not only that we're, and as Appalachians too, not only that we're not just one thing or one idea, but that if we limit ourselves to being that one thing or that one idea, our food's not as interesting, our places aren't as interesting, you know, that we are all, I think, enriched by that diversity, and most particularly through food.
That's a tremendous answer. One thing I think with that, we all, even as diverse as we are, as we've identified, one thing that we can connect to in regards to Appalachian food, Appalachian cuisine, is kind of how we as a culture have been shaped by the terrain of the mountains, of the valleys, of the forest. You know, we've kind of developed this culture of self-reliance we have a history of preserving or canning kind of out of necessity, which is how a lot of our food was developed, or foodways were developed. And so we also have developed this kind of deep, deep connection to the land. I think it's important for wherever you're from in Appalachia, we have this deep connection to the land. So we've heard these terms that are, now becoming popularized, organic sustainability or doing farm to table. That's something that Appalachians have been doing forever out of necessity. You know, mm-hmm. it's just the way that it's always been. And to that point, do you think it's, I don't know, all these celebrity chefs that are doing it now, do you think it's disrespectful that are people that are claiming it as their own? Or do you think it's a sign of respect for kind of recognizing the wisdom of Appalachia over the years, if that makes sense?
And I'm pretty sure my mom invented it, so.
Exactly. you know, I always find this question really funny because, I mean, I don't know about y'all, but like, I'm a lot older than y'all. I'm old enough that, let me just say, I remember, I can tell you like almost to the minute when Middlesboro, Kentucky got a Burger King. And then when subsequently we finally got a McDonald's.
Oh, McDonald's.
That's like,
that was a family trip to McDonald's in Middlesboro.
Oh my gosh, right. So, you know, what I find, you know, one of the things that I always kind of, you know, this is like running in my head as people like do farm to table. I'm like, you know, you have no idea how hard we ran from farm to table. Like we were so like, you know, in line to get a French fries. So I think that, I think it's respect. I mean, I think that the sort of the bigger impact of the farm to table movement is, I think that people want to and clearly enjoy feeling like they understand where their food comes from, who grew it, who prepared it, and kind of, you know, why this dish in this moment. And I think that, I mean, this is we're talking like baby steps. I mean, but I really do think that that is a baby step into the larger sustainability conversation that the whole world is going to need to have in the next 50 years. I don't know that the way we eat as a country is necessarily sustainable into the next millennium. And I think that having curious and educated eaters ultimately is going to help everybody. So it doesn't bother me when people are, you know, when a restaurant like Husk says essentially we're going hyper local. If it's not produced in the South, it doesn't come in the doors. I like that. I like that challenge, and I like the exploration of what's possible there. And I think that there are people, you know, y'all probably know about Bill Best, who's the seed saver based somewhere, I think, outside of Berea. The very first film the SFA ever made was about him. I think that stories like his are actually more common than we realize. And I think that understanding that a way of life where maybe you're not on a farm, maybe you're not like growing everything you eat, but a way of life where you honor that, where, you know, you try to grow a $50 tomato from time to time. Like, I think all of that, tiny, tiny steps to making us both appreciate the food we eat and to understanding what we're going to need to do to feed ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, there's some great people doing it, you know, the Sean Brocks, the Travis Miltons,
yes,
the Bob Costellos, the yep, Kristen Smiths.
Oh, yeah, Portland. Exactly. I was going to say, y'all got somebody close.
Yeah, there's some
amazing people. Neil does, not you.
Yeah, right, exactly. amazing people doing it. And I mean, Neil and I, we grew up with cornbread at every meal. You know, fresh tomatoes and cucumbers, that was just a staple on the table. It was almost like salt and pepper. You had tomatoes and cucumbers. When that McDonald's came in, it was definitely or Taco Casa in the mall right before you went to a movie.
Exactly.
See, I can talk about that with you because you know what I'm talking about.
to that point, you mentioned a couple of classics there, Burger King, McDonald's, and Taco Casa. What's your favorite? If you had to go get a quick meal, what would be your favorite fast food restaurant?
I'm all about the fast casual these days, I gotta tell you. And we're weird fact about Oxford, Mississippi. Both McAllisters and Nukes started here. And so I'm pretty much a Nukes stan, I gotta tell you. Like, and so like I kind of get happy now, because I mean, for what, 6 years, 7 years, like you could only have Nukes here in Oxford. Now you can have it everywhere. But yeah, that's my favorite.
You go to.
Yeah.
What about restaurants in general? Do you have a favorite restaurant outside of the fast casual?
Whoa, that's a tough question, I imagine.
Yeah, no, that's.
I mean, I mean, and this is true.
Are you allowed to answer that question?
Exactly. So here in Oxford, there is a restaurant, actually, dude with a Kentucky connection, restaurant I love here in Oxford called Snack Bar. The chef is his name is Vishwesh Bhatt. He went to the University of Kentucky and he came to Oxford and started working in a restaurant. And he actually, I guess this turned out to be the last time they gave James Beard Award. Vish won for best chef South. And what he does, which is fantastic, is he was born in, I think, in Gujarat, India. What he does is take okra and turns it into the most amazing okra chaat you could imagine. He is all about taking the ingredients and preparations of his native India and applying them to his adopted Kentucky and Mississippi. And it's hands down, it's my favorite dining experience really anywhere. So, and you know, back to that earlier question, there's only so much fried okra a person can eat. And so, you know, having somebody who, you know, comes from a background who feels as strongly about it as any Southerner, but with a whole different approach, is so exciting.
But does he serve bourbon?
Yes, he does. He does.
So do you have a favorite film that you guys have made? I know you told us about the first film, but have you guys put together a film that just really sticks out to you that you would tell our listeners to definitely listen to or watch?
I still love that first film. I think probably my favorite, I've got two favorites. One is about Helen Turner, who, and the film is called Helen's Barbecue. Helen is actually one of the few women who owns a barbecue restaurant. She's in Brownsville, Tennessee, which is kind of between Jackson and Memphis. So I love that Helen's film. My other favorite is a film that we have called Cud, C-U-D, about Will Harris, who is a fifth generation cattle farmer in South Georgia. And there's a follow-up to that film about his daughter, Jenny Harris, who is now running the family business. So those, I would say that those three, as kind of a, if I had to pick, those three are big favorites, but just because those folks are so compelling. So, yeah.
Cool.
I had a question. My mom, very interested and big on recipes, as a lot of Appalachians are, handing down recipes. A lot of times when she hands them down to us, they get lightened up a little bit.
Yes.
Maybe a half stick of butter instead of a full stick or something right. Like that. But, you know, I know that the Foxfire book series, which, mm-hmm. you know, started as a high school project in Georgia, it's played an important role in kind of preserving Appalachian foodways. But mm-hmm. can you speak to a little bit to how important recipes are, especially in Appalachia, and how they've kind of been preserved or handed down over the years?
Yeah, I think, you know, in there's a lot of church cookbooks. I think that's probably your you know, your best indicator of kind of what's happening in the moment in Southern food. Although I find church cookbooks are fascinating because often like there'll be like something in the church cookbook that you're like, I know I read that in Southern Living. Like, you just took that directly from Southern Living. You started making it, and now, like, here it is. But anyway, that aside, so I think church cookbooks have been a good resource. I do think that publications like Southern Living played a role. That one's trickier because they played a role in sort of the homogenization of Southern food. But they've also played a role in sharing important recipes. And then, you know, I'm sitting here. This is my grandmother's
recipe box.
Yes. And, nice. You know, this is one of the things that, like, as we were cleaning out the house, I took it. And it's, you can see it's full of, like, newspapers and handwritten things. And I will say, and this is, you know, this is being felt, I think, in every small town in the South, the importance of a food page in a newspaper, I think, cannot be, like, understated. And, you know, and especially for kind of the more remote areas of Kentucky, I think daily newspapers had a huge role in sharing recipes. There are a couple of cookbook books. Joe Dabney, who actually just died a couple years ago, wrote a James Beard award-winning cookbook about Appalachian foodways. And it's called something like Spoon Bread, Country Ham, and something, something. I should have it memorized because...
Stepanagwan.
Yeah, that's the one. That book... As an aspiring cook, before I ever came to the Southern Foodways Alliance to work, that book was really the book that made it clear to me that I had a food culture and that I had come from a valuable food, from a food culture that was valued by others. So I think, and I still think that's a really important book. And then Ronnie Lundy's most recent book, Vittles, is also a fantastic exploration. I will also say the folks at Blackberry Farm, who are doing a lot of work with seed saving and Appalachian, like, foodways promotion, their books are really good in terms of thinking about every Southerner worth her salt can make it through the summer on, like, roasting ears and tomatoes and cucumbers. But, you know, come fall and winter, things start to get trickier. And I think the folks at Blackberry Farm are doing a really good job in the promotion of, I think this term was kind of coined with them, foothills cuisine.
Yeah.
This, you know, so for all of us who are living, like, you know, not at the top of the mountain, but somewhere in the holler, there's, you know, there's something in there for you if you're interested.
It's funny you grabbed that recipe box. That was our aunt took the recipe pot. Well, she didn't take it, but she got the recipe box when my grandparents passed away from my grandmother, and she photocopied it all and put it in a binder and gave it to all the grandkids, which I thought was one of the coolest Christmas gifts that we got.
You may have known our grandparents. I don't know, or at least knew their business on your way through Bell County, Roland Chevrolet.
Yeah. Yes. I know exactly where that is.
Log Mountain.
I was going to say right up Log Mountain.
Part of the 13th. So you were a Yellow Jacket, right?
Yes, absolutely. Listen, y'all, not only was I a Yellow Jacket, I was the voice of Fulton Gymnasium. I was the public address announcer for basketball games for 4 years.
That is impressive.
From, let's see, so that would have been like 1982 to 85. Yeah, that was my gig. So I was all about a 13th region basketball game.
Was that Richie Farmer years? Russ Farmer?
So Richie.
Was
so
that Russ?
No, that was Richie. Richie was in eighth grade my senior year, but was already playing.
Yeah.
I remember you couldn't park a car on Log Mountain when the 13th region came to Bell County.
Yeah.
Couldn't find a spot.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you I have five. I didn't tell Neil I was going to ask this question, but I have five Appalachian foods that I'm kind of curious, not curious about, but I guess have questions about. And I wanted to see if I could ask you and see if you had an answer to them.
Okay. And if I don't know, I'll tell you I don't know.
All right. Well, it's not that kind of answer. But the first one is the traditional cornbread. So, you know, I live in Cleveland. And up here, my kids think cornbread is the dessert you get after the meal because it's got so much sugar in it. Mm-hmm. So cornbread, sugar, no sugar.
So that's a tough one. There are people who say it shouldn't have sugar in it. The problem with that is, in addition to being like, initially the thought was that's a North-South thing, but it's also a Black-White question.
Really?
So it's, yeah. So there are Black communities, Black foodways traditions that always have a little sugar in the cornbread. So I think that I'm agnostic on that question. I mean, it depends on what you want. And I think that that's not an argument that I've ever felt strongly about.
Yeah, I just always wondered, like, when I go to Boston Market, I save my cornbread to last because it tastes
Those commercial cornbreads, it really might as well be cake.
Just cake. Okay, my second food. Growing up, if we didn't go to the hospital or Pizza Hut on Sundays after church, or got Kentucky Fried Chicken, then she always fixed.
I'm sorry, I love that y'all were eating at the hospital. I was getting ready
to explain that. I was like, oh my gosh, our listeners are going to think our parents took us to the hospital on Sunday.
Just like, so good.
I'm in no way. Like, I'm
the
not
Pineville Hospital food used to be so good back in the day.
It was the best.
Funny.
So if we didn't do those three, my mom, she always cooked breakfast for the meal after church on Sundays. And so one thing that was a staple was sausage gravy. She always sticks sausage gravy. But the other gravy that's kind of Appalachian, which we never had a lot, was red eye gravy.
Right.
I guess the question is, have you ever fixed red eye gravy, and do you like red eye gravy?
I do like it. Red eye gravy is country ham based. So it's really, I'm just going to say it, it's salty. And so, it is like, if you're going to go work outside all afternoon and sweat, it's basically probably the equivalent of like pickle juice or any of those other like performance enhancers you buy now. I don't love it. I grew up on sausage gravy, which my parents called sawmill gravy. I don't know why.
I've heard that.
I love sausage gravy. What I hate are commercial versions of it because it's not brown enough and it's too thick. The kind that my mother had like a special, she only made it in her electric skillet because she felt like she could control the heat better. But like I can like the smell, the all of it. Yes. So I'm more sausage gravy than red eye gravy.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess the next is the third food is we have ears of corn. Corn on the cob, you can cut it off, but fried corn. I feel like that's an Appalachian staple. I know my mom used to freeze fried corn. We would have a freezer full of fried corn.
You'll do.
So do you eat fried corn? What's your preference? Corn on the cob, cut off the cob, or fried corn?
I like fried corn. One of my mother's best friends mother went to LMU over in Harrogate.
Yeah.
And one of her best friends from college does fried corn every summer, freezes it. And then she would give mother two containers of it every year right before Christmas. So like that corn was a part of like Christmas dinner every single year. And I love it. I have never been able to get it right when I do it myself. I've tried various ways. I mean, I just like corn. So like I'll try it all kinds of ways, but that particular, like, cause there's like a creaminess to it. It's not creamed corn. It is fried corn. I don't know. I've never been able to replicate it.
The next food is poke salad. So dangerous or not dangerous. Have you ever fixed poke salad? I know I grew up eating it, but.
I've never fixed it, and I don't know. I know that I have had it. I mean, sure, it's probably, it's dangerous, but I mean, everybody eats, everybody who cares about sushi is after that, like, fish that can kill you. So, I mean, I guess I'm kind of by poke salad, like I am by mushrooms. Like, I want to know what you know about mushrooms before I eat this mushroom that you found. And I want to know, like, what you know about poke salad before I eat your poke salad. So.
Gotcha. Number five is, you mentioned how laborious one of your appetizers was.
The custard. Yeah.
Which is another thing of this number five, apple stack cake, which is a traditional Appalachian dessert, but it also takes, which a lot of Appalachian dishes do, takes a long time to make. Is that something that you make, that you like, apple stack cake?
It is not something that I love them. I do not make them, because the challenge with them is for them to work and to, like, have that taste, you need somebody who dried the apples first. So, you know, you gotta start in September, in order to have this cake. There's a woman who was a part of the SFA, who is a part of the SFA, just a member, who a few years ago, we did a summer symposium in Bristol, Virginia, and she makes stack cakes in the way that, you know, her mother and grandmother did, and then taught a class on them as part of the weekend. And, you know, they're extraordinary. And the thing I hate the most is when somebody says they're about to give you a stack cake and then it turns out to just be a layer cake. Yeah, right. Which happens a lot. Like, you, as soon as you look you at it, you're like.
Because like you said, you can't just make a stack cake on the fly, right?
You just, you know, I mean, the thing, the actual, like, making the layers is easier because they're thinner, they cook faster, like, all of that is true. It's just that apple butter, apple stuff that goes between each layer is the labor intensive part. And, you know, and that takes time and a knowledge of preserving.
Can I ask a bonus?
Sure.
Neil, I'll let you get in here too, but the bonus one. So I grew up, my dad would feed us souse meat.
Yes.
And for the listeners that don't know, I don't know if you need to know what souse meat is, but I loved it until I found out what it was. And yeah. So it, for the listeners that don't know, you know, the Appalachian tradition is whole hog, use all the hog, and souse meat is essentially hog head cheese. So it was, regardless, it was the head of the hog that went into souse meat. And so that kind of ruined it for me. I don't think I've eaten it since I found out what it was, but do you like souse meat?
I have eaten souse. We, in fact, one time at an SFA event, we served souse meat sandwiches on white bread with mustard for breakfast. And people were, like, totally into them. And then there were other people who were into them because they knew what they were eating. And then there were people who were into them because they tasted good. And then they found out and they're kind of mad and whatever. I like souse. I will eat souse. I will eat sweetbreads. I don't seek them out. Like, I'll seek out a really well fried chicken liver, but I won't go looking for souse or sweetbreads.
Well, growing up, my dad used to. He doesn't anymore, but he growing up, he used to, and he used to give it to us without. And we loved it. We loved it.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know any better. I'm
just kind of bringing it back to Appalachia, or just kind of where you're from. Another question that we always ask all our guests is, you know, you mentioned you live in Oxford, but you grew up in Middlesbrough. Where do you call home and why do you call it home? What makes it unique to you?
So that's a tough question for me right now. My mother died in December of 2017, and I'm an only child. My father died when I was 12. So I have my aunt, my mother's sister is kind of the last family I have in Middlesbrough. You know, I think even after all this time, I've been in Oxford for 20 years. We've been married 29 years, you know, so I don't know that it's Middlesbrough anymore, but it's definitely still Kentucky for me. And I think about that a lot because I could not wait to get out of Middlesbrough. you know, when I was at Center, when I was Chase, you know, I was open to Lexington or Louisville as where I might land, but, you know, I didn't think it would be there. And I think there's a way in which for both of us, my husband too, I think, I don't know that we'll ever get back there, but I think we'll always want to. That's evident in probably a million things about us, not the least of which is, you know, I live in Oxford, Mississippi. I think I last went to an Ole Miss football game 10 years ago.
But you're part of the Big Blue Nation, right?
But Lord, am I part of the Big Blue Nation. I mean, you know, we've raised two sons who are UK fans. You know, I could go get all of the UK gear that's in this house. In fact, I don't know if you can see it. Do you see that Jamal Mashburn is here?
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yes.
So
old school.
Very old school. I was at the Big Blue Madness when they gave those out. So I think that in my what I'm realizing is that in my sensibilities, in the ridiculous things I care about, like college sports. And just in my head, in my heart, I'm always going to think of myself as a Kentuckian first.
Melissa, we want to thank you again. We appreciate all and the vast amount of information that you provided.
Sorry.
No.
I'm not good at the soundbite.
It was perfect. Thank you so much for being a part of this. And thank you for your willingness.
I'm up in the mountains again. I'm getting lighter. Air's getting thin. Now I'm facing down with a grin. I've been in the city too long. Sidewalks and buildings and singing sad songs. Now I'm back up where I belong. In the mountains.